this evening. The subject is very appropriate. Those of you who read the Globe and Mail, Jan Wong, who is a tender 45 years of age, has a very lengthy column about her aging brain and how she's forgetting names of people and places and so on. Before I introduce our speaker, however, I would like to remind you that this is the culmination of UBC Celebrate Research Week that has had a number of lectures and special events highlighting the great work that's going on here, different branches of the university. I served for 3 years on the Canadian Foundation for Innovation Committee here at UBC, and it was really impressive to see the kind of projects going on. One of the most successful people at getting money from that great federal cash cow matched with provincial funds is our speaker tonight. The Institute is very pleased to be able to feature such speakers, and our program chair, Peter Nemetz, has a brilliant ability at picking people at the right time. I mean, who would have thought there would have been a big article on aging brains in the Globe today? But we do need your support, and we encourage you to join if any of you would like to further our aims. I know many of you are members. It's tax deductible. That time of the year is coming up. And there is someone out at the desk to take memberships. To remind you as well of upcoming lectures, next week on the 19th, we have the Romans in Scotland, Roman in the Gloman. Their far frontier with Professor Lawrence Kepi from the University of Glasgow. Professor Kepi is a Cecil and Ida Green lecturer here at UBC. I've heard him speak 3 times so far this week, and he's a very good speaker, very entertaining, very light touch, and I think you'll find his talk next Saturday quite informative and entertaining. Then we have a break for Easter, and then we have another very distinguished scholar, James Cahill, Professor Emeritus of Art at the University of California at Berkeley, who is the leading authority on Chinese art in North America. And he is going to do an exposé of the truth about Chinese art. So there's a great deal to see and do here, and we're starting tonight with one of UBC's most distinguished speakers. Many of you probably seen his name in the paper. I'm sure he has a full-time clipping agency going to cut them all out. For example, last year he received the BC Science and Technology Award as Champion of the Year. Just a word or two from their citation. Brain diseases such as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's will impose more burdens on society as Canada's aging population reaches its peak in the next few decades. Fortunately, BC is home to one of the top brain research centers in the world, and the center's achievements can be traced to one man, Dr. Max Snyder. Professor Snyder was raised in Montreal, educated at McGill University with a PhD from MIT in 1972. He did postdoctoral work at the Max Planck Institute in Germany and then held positions at Dalhousie and came here soon afterward. His particular accomplishment at Dalhousie was he was the racket champion of the university while he was there. His accomplishments are too numerous to give all of here, but he's held the Killam Research Prize at UBC, the Distinguished Medical Research Lecturer, the Honor Roll of Maclean's Magazine, the Gold Medal in Health Sciences from the Science Council of British Columbia. He served as the president of the Canadian Association for Neuroscience and has sat on many scientific and advisory review panels. He and his collaborators, and he also has patents and companies, have been at the forefront of new approaches to the identification of genes and gene products associated with brain plasticity and with various types of neuronal injuries. His research group has developed new viral vector systems to effectively transfer potentially therapeutic genes into specific neuronal populations. The work that he is doing focuses on many areas, but one that is of particular interest, especially to this audience tonight, I saw people arriving at 7:45 to be sure to get a seat, is the aging brain. And I now ask you to welcome Professor Max Snyder.
Well, thank you very much, Hector, for that lovely introduction. And it's a pleasure for me to be here this evening speaking with you about the aging brain, a subject with which I am intimately familiar as I cross into my 50s and am on my way to my 60s quite soon. I put this first slide up to remind myself and you about my day job, which is director of the Brain Research Center at UBC and Vancouver Coastal Health. We're actually very proud of what we've been able to accomplish in the Brain Research Center in the last 10 years since it really got started. The diseases of the brain represent a formidable societal challenge. Tonight, I'm going to be speaking about the diseases that affect the aging brain, but there are lots of diseases of the brain that affect young people. The prime time age for developing schizophrenia is 19. Multiple sclerosis hits women primarily between the ages of 20 and 40. And diseases like autism, fetal alcohol syndrome, dyslexia, attention deficit disorder rob our young of their promise. So we've got lots to do. Today we're going to be speaking about one particular program, the aging brain. But when you see the slide, I want you to remember that there are lots of other topics that we can't cover tonight. And perhaps if you invite me again, I'll give you a different talk. The aging brain. We've got a lot more old people or aging people than we did before, and that's good news. You know, 100 years ago, the average lifespan was only 48, and now we've got people routinely living into their 70s, 80s, 90s, and we seem to be gaining about 3 months every year in average lifespan. So that's good. That's good news. The bad news is that every day in Canada, more and more people become seniors. And we predict that by 2030, 25% of the population will be seniors. And that, of course, imposes tremendous costs and potential burdens on society. And as I look around at this audience, I see a fair number of people who are, over 39. So we all have an obligation to, to age well, if only for the rest of society. So what I'd like to do first is just tell you a little bit about our center and how it's organized. We have a series of different pillars, which represent different diseases that people work on: vision, multiple sclerosis, neurodegeneration, stroke, trauma, mental illness. And underneath it, we have two big technology platforms that support all these pillars, and they're called genomics and imaging. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about how those platforms help to support some of these disease initiatives. And also, underneath the genomics and imaging platforms, we have two programs, one called the Learning Brain, which is another talk. And today I'm going to tell you about our Aging Brain program. So the goals of our Aging Brain program are as follows. How can we prevent the declines in memory and cognitive capacities that can occur with aging? Over there I put down occur, but I really meant can occur. And can we prevent and treat neurodegenerative disorders? Can we increase the human lifespan? So these are the goals of our program. I hope to talk about all of them to a greater or lesser extent. But the other thing, since this is the Vancouver Institute and a public lecture, I've been charged by Sid and Hector with giving you useful, practical information, things that'll make you live longer, live better. So I don't know whether any of you brought along note paper or anything like this, but you may want to take some notes to, when I come across these important these important points. So okay, let me give you some advice on how to live well and to live long and prosper, as Mr. Spock likes to say. So my first bit of advice, and you may want to write this down, is to choose a good set of parents. Okay, so I'm showing you this slide to remind us that genetic factors play an important point, play an important role in longevity. You can treat longevity as, you know, any other trait. You can treat it like flat feet. And if you look at, you know, people who've had a long life, and then you ask, do their children tend to have long lives? The answer is yes. And you can look at parents who've had short lives and ask whether their children tend to have short lives. The answer is, unfortunately, yes. And you can look at twins and see correlations in their longevity. And you can look at identical twins versus fraternal twins. And you can tease out genetic factors in longevity, just as you can tease out genetic factors in flat feet. So there's no question that this is one important contribution. In fact, my very first ever job was as an actuarial trainee. I got a summer job for an insurance company. And there, you know, the insurance agents would send in these applications, and I, at the age of 17, would read them and pass judgment on whether this person was insurable or not. And one of the important things you were taught right at the outset, amazing, 17-year-olds doing this job. One of the important things you were taught was look at the parent's age. If the parents die young, the person is either not insurable or less insurable. So we've known this for quite a while. So having said this, and you're looking at a slide of a gene and a computer, a DNA molecule, of the double helix, and a computer to remind us of this, it's not just genes. Because remember what I told you a little while ago. In 1900, the average lifespan was 48. And in 2005, the average lifespan is 76 or 77. So nothing has happened to our genes in the last 100 years. We still have the same genes. So what this points to is the importance of non-genetic factors as well in the aging process and in the longevity process. So let me ask you this. If you could only know one thing about somebody, what would you want to know in order to predict their longevity? Smoking, okay. Cholesterol levels. Wait, BMI. Their state of happiness. Well, I'll tell you what it is. There is actually, it's actually none of the above. If you can only know one thing about someone to predict their longevity, the answer is, if it's a male, it's their income on the day they retire. Okay? It turns out that that is the best single predictor of longevity, if you're a male, okay? So that brings me to my second bit of advice, which you also may want to write down, which is be rich. Very, very rich. And I certainly recommend that. So what does it mean to be, you know, why does that work? I mean, what does that, you know, what does that actually indicate? Well, we think what it indicates is two things. That marker, your income on the day you retire, is a surrogate for many other factors, a surrogate for a good education, a surrogate for a well-organized brain early in life leading to successes, for a stimulating lifestyle, and for an avoidance of stress. So there's another study that really comes to the same conclusion. This is the mortality among, this is the Whitehall study, which indicates the mortality of British civil servants as a function of their rank within the British civil servants. Okay? So the higher the bar, the quicker you die. So the support staff dies most quickly, then the clerical staff, then the professional staff, and then the senior, the assistant deputy ministers and deputy ministers, people like this. And this is true, by the way, even after you parse out all the obvious variables. You parse out smoking, you parse out obvious heart disease, you parse out lots of other things, and it's still there. And in fact, it's not easy to explain on biological grounds at all. And what we think it is, again, it's a stimulating lifestyle, and it's the ability to delegate your stress to someone else. So, so the senior people have no trouble delegating it, and it all gets worse and worse as you work your way to the right of that graph. Okay. So, how does this actually happen? Well, your brain controls your stress response system. So, we have lots of stressors in our lives. They're not the same as the stressors of our ancestors, but they too had stresses. When, let's say you're, you know, a caveman and you're wandering through the savanna, and you know, you see the lion in the bushes. Information comes in through your visual system, your auditory system, your olfactory system, goes through your cortex, and it's transmitted to those 5 grams of neural tissue called the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus controls your emotions, controls your pituitary, which then controls your adrenal gland, which secretes cortisol. The cortisol is released. It's the acute response to stress. It pumps blood to your legs, cuts off blood to your digestive system. You're not interested in eating now. You're interested in running as fast as you can. And you do. And that's great. So you need your stress response system, and you escape, hopefully. Acute stress is okay. You need your stress response system. But chronic stress is not good for you. There's abundant evidence that if you chronically overactivate this hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, that you get suppression of your immune system, you get gastrointestinal problems, and the cortisol coming back into your brain for a long period of time is actually toxic to neurons and will kill brain cells over time. Okay, so acute stress, fine. Long-term chronic stress, bad. So the responses we have to stress, though, have not evolved. So, you know, this is it's an appropriate response to seeing the lion in the bush to shunt blood to your legs and run away. But if you're coming in on the Lion's Gate Bridge, which is what I do every day, and it's going to be a long and obnoxious week, perhaps, and somebody cuts you off yet again, what's your reaction? Well, you shunt blood to your legs. How helpful is that? Okay. So the responses are really very much the same, but they're less adaptive now in many cases than they were then. And the problem of chronic stress is quite a serious one in our society. So I forgot to tell you one thing about men rich men living long, okay? And that's that that statistic applies very well to men. It doesn't apply all that well to women, because women tend to do work which is not appropriately compensated, I think is probably the best single way to describe it. And so the correlation between income and longevity in women is not as clear. The other point that I would make is it turns out that that statistic only applies to married men. And if a man is not married, it's the equivalent of losing about 50% of their salary, or at least half their wealth. Okay. So for women, it turns out marriage is sort of a mild negative. So which brings me to my next bit of advice, which is if you're a man, fall in love. Deliriously in love. If you're a woman, well, I don't know. And I offer you this quote from Jean Moreau. So This is all useful information, but I dare say none of you is going to live much longer based on the advice that I have given you so far. So I'm here to tell you now that there is, in fact, something that we can all do. We can start tomorrow morning that will prolong our lives, all of our lives. And not only that, but prolong our lives in a, you know, healthy and productive manner to enable us to avoid neurodegeneration and many of the slings and arrows that normally beset us. And this is not a supplement of any kind, because I can tell you that there is no clinically demonstrated evidence for enhanced longevity as a result of any supplement. And that goes for ginkgo biloba and green tea and the entire litany of things that you might expect me to support. There's no evidence in humans of life extension by any of these things. So I'm not saying that they may not, I'm just saying that there is at this moment no documented evidence. But there is very good evidence for the thing I'm about to tell you next, and that is very simple. Eat less. Eat less. So there have now been many studies in animals ranging from worms to Drosophila, fruit flies, to mice, to rats, to dogs, and the NIH is just completing a long study in monkeys showing that if you eat less, you live longer. So how does a study like this go? A typical study is you take one bunch of rats and you put them in an environment and you let them eat as much as they want. And then you take another group of rats, you put them in a similar environment, and you let them eat 90% of what the free-feeding rats are eating. So they have 10% food deprivation. And it turns out that the hungry rats live 10% longer. Not bad. You go on, now you do 20%. And they live 20% longer. 30%. And they live 30% longer. And it actually goes on till about 40%. So you can, if you have the discipline to reduce your caloric intake by 40%, you will, on average, if you're a rat, live 40% longer. Okay. So the numbers are, the truth is that the numbers are not as clear in the human and the monkey studies because they're just much harder to do. It takes a lot longer. But there are studies going on now in humans of food deprivation, food restriction, and they're actually, again, looking fairly promising. They're hard to do. People cheat. It's not easy. but basically, as far as we know, this does work. Now, the first studies, the initial studies were done in young animals. You know, the animals were weaned, and then they were put on this regime for their whole lives. And I thought, well, great, I don't have to do this. Started, it's way too late for me. But the answer is, now studies have been done which start with older animals. So let's say the typical lifespan of a rat would be 30 months. And at 24 months of age, you start one group of animals on a caloric restriction diet, and they live longer. They live an extra couple of months. So they gain as much, they gain the same fraction that they would have gained. They gain 40% more life than they would have had otherwise. So that's useful, or potentially useful. So what are we doing in the Brain Research Center? Well, we're excited by these kinds of findings. What we're trying to do is to go beyond those actual sort of nostrums or findings and to say what's actually going on inside the brain of an animal who has been calorically restricted. What's different? What happens? How can we manipulate a model organism and see which one, and see how to get longer life? So again, here we just take advantage of the fantastic revolution in genomics that is transforming biology everywhere we look. We now have, for instance, Don Moorman in the C. elegans knockout facility at UBC has worms, which every gene you want is knocked out. you can just, you know, you call him and he will deliver one to you, frozen. And then you can start to breed them together and knock two of them out. Or, you know, there really is a tremendous ability now to understand the genetic complement of worms and even people. So you can take all these people who are 100 years, you know, who make it to 100, and you can say, what's different about their genetic complement? What's different about their biology? As opposed to people who die younger. So I'll show you this slide, which is sort of an interesting one. It's the DNA molecule, as you will recognize. But notice it's been, I've put it in the form of a piano, okay? And because I want you to actually think about genes and gene expression as a piano. So we've got 30,000 human genes, okay? Every cell in our body has all 30,000 genes within it. But it turns out you can think about it really as a concerto almost, okay? Imagine a keyboard with 30,000 keys, okay? So in your brain, in one cell in your brain, you'll have all 30,000 genes, the potential ability to press all 30,000 keys, but you won't actually press all 30,000. Your brain will turn on some of those genes early in life. It'll turn on some of those genes only when it's defending itself against some insult. It'll turn on some of those genes only when a brain cell is learning something new. It'll turn on a different chord, for instance, when it's thinking about committing suicide, which brain cells do all the time, unfortunately. And so what we now have the ability to do is to see what music is playing inside the cells of our brain, what 30,000 note chords are playing inside the cells of an animal who is calorically restricted, of an animal who is going to live longer, of people who have successfully aged, and people who have not. And this next slide just shows you a tiny bit of a gene chip. You can make them here, you can buy them commercially, and you can look. If you look at that screen, you see that there are lots of potential black spots, and some of them are in fact black, and what that tells you is that in that tissue at that time, under those circumstances, those genes were turned on, and others were not. And that's the kind of thing we can now do. So this is, again, fantastic, was not possible at all before the Human Genome Project came to fruition, and of course now really gives us the ability to interrogate the genetic programs within our body in a way that was just not possible. So what are the results of all of this? Well, there are lots and lots of results, and I'm not going to take you through them all. But let me just give you a few simple... what we have done as a result of this is to identify some pathways that really appear to be important to living long. So the bad news first. Oxygen is toxic. Okay. There's a great quote from one of my colleagues who says, every breath a person takes hastens his own death. Okay. You know. So if oxygen were to come before the FDA today for approval as a new drug, I can assure you it would fail. They would say, efficacious? Yes. Lots of side effects. Nasty side effects. So if you think about it, you know, we take in oxygen, we have reactions inside our cells. Our brain cells are particularly vulnerable because, by and large, we're not making any more. We've got all the brain cells that we're going to have. And a series of chemical reactions occur inside the mitochondria of these cells. And it goes pretty well, by and large. But every once in a while, it's not perfectly efficient, and free radicals leak out. And those radicals cause damage to cell membranes, to proteins, to fats, and to DNA. And the slings and arrows accumulate over time and you've got problems. So what people have shown is that if you manipulate various antioxidant defense systems, that can be very helpful in prolonging life. A similar story for glucose. It's also bad for you. And by the way, many things converge to glucose. It results in the release of basically it also causes the release of various bad actors inside your cells, which eventually will bring you down. Against this, we have pathways that defend us, oxidative stress-relating defense pathways. We have DNA repair pathways. And by goosing them up, we can help. Okay. So this is a very brief description of of an enormous area of research, but it looks now as though we can identify a series of mutations in some of our animal models that will result in prolonged life. It's not hard now. You can go onto a website called sagek.org. And you can see a list of the mutations and the knockouts and overexpression mutants that will result in prolonged life. And so now, in an animal like a worm, we can get worms that live 6 times as long as the normal worms. Okay, by manipulating, by the sort of the best cocktails of manipulating the insulin signaling pathway and the apoptosis pathway and the DNA repair enzymes and the oxidative stress and, giving them, we've contributed to RRSPs for these worms to make them rich as well. So we can get substantial increases in longevity in these animals. So the future, at some level, does look actually quite bright. What I'd like to do now is just turn to some of the diseases that affect the aging brain, because it's great to live long, but if we all don't remember who we are, that's not going to be very much fun. So let me just talk about a few diseases. I'll start out by talking about Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's is the most common of the neurodegenerative disorders that leads to dementia. 10% of the population over 65 years of age suffers from Alzheimer's. So it's a pretty grim statistic. If you make it to 85, the odds are 40% that you will have at least what is called mild cognitive impairment, which is pretty much on the road to Alzheimer's disease. So it's a tremendous problem that our society is facing. It's the fourth most common cause of death right now. And it's not a quick disease. You know, as if you develop Alzheimer's, you have a course of several years during which you go downhill and you take a tremendous toll on yourself, on your family, caregivers, and the health system. So we feel the pressure, if you will, to do something about this. I should tell you that even now we don't have a good diagnosis. You know, the diagnosis now depends on the skill of the clinician. We can't just, you know, here's a blood test, and you know, just because you don't remember that it's Wednesday, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not Wednesday, is it? Okay. just because you don't know that it's Saturday, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have Alzheimer's disease. You know, you may have other problems. You may be hypoglycemic. We still don't have good tests for this disease, but we are now rapidly understanding exactly what is wrong in the brain of the Alzheimer's patient. So if you look here, you see at high magnification in the center the orange plaque, which is located inside the brain, surrounded by these neurofibrillary tangles, which occur in the brain of Alzheimer's patients. So these plaques can happen in normal brains as people get older, but they are much more prevalent in the brain of Alzheimer's patients. And that's how we know finally for sure that this person had Alzheimer's, because we slice their brain up at the, you know, after they die, and we can see that. That doesn't really help us very much. But we do know a tremendous amount, and we have learned a tremendous amount about what these plaques are made of. We now know that they're made of a particular protein called beta amyloid protein. We know the enzymes that cleave this beta amyloid fragment off from a larger precursor protein. We know their names. They've been cloned in the last few years. We know, therefore, how this is made. We know how it is normally degraded. We've identified the enzymes. And it looks as though, you know, Alzheimer's disease is it's a very boring problem at some level. It's just a matter of a small mismatch between synthesis and degradation. You just don't carry out the garbage quite as often as you ought to. You know, you need some of this beta amyloid, but you don't need as much as you have. And if you have too much of it, it starts to stick to itself and become insoluble and just clumps together. And then it's very hard to break up. So if I was to take the brain of an Alzheimer's patient and put it down on this lectern, okay, and just go away for, I don't know, 3 months, you know, the whole thing would, over 3 months, would pretty well turn to mush. And what would be left were those plaques. They're hard, they're insoluble, and they're just like millions of tiny little pebbles inside your head. And what we have to do is to prevent them from forming or figure out ways to break them down more efficiently. And that's really the challenge. And we're working very hard at this in the Brain Research Center. So if we're not successful, the disease progresses. And you can see on the right a normal brain, and you can see on the left the brain of a patient with Alzheimer's disease. And you see that the sulci, you know, the U-shaped things in the on the cortex are much bigger. That's because the whole cortex has atrophied. Brain cells have died. Once these plaques form, they attract other bad actors that are trying to clear them up, and in so doing, they do more damage, and you basically have a pretty bad situation. Now, Alzheimer's is not genetic in the sense that it's like if your father and mother both had Alzheimer's disease at 75, the odds are really not particularly higher that you're going to have it. But it does look as though about 5% of it, or 5 to 10% of it perhaps, has very clear genetic risk factors. And there is a form of Alzheimer's that some people get in their 40s and their 50s, which is different and which has a clear genetic predisposition. Now, in studying this form, several genes have been cloned and identified as being important for causing Alzheimer's. We can now take those same mutations and put them into mice. So we now have mice in the next building over there that if we don't do anything, these animals will develop Alzheimer's. They'll start out okay, and then as they get older, their brains will fill with plaques and tangles. They will become demented, they will show memory problems, and they will die of Alzheimer's disease. And what's good about that is that we can then try out our latest strategies in these mice. And I just want to show you some results obtained by one of the labs in the Brain Research Center, the lab of Dr. Weihong Song. This is not a normal mouse. It's the mutant mouse that will develop Alzheimer's. And if you look over here, you see all these plaques. There they are, and they're in this part of the brain called the hippocampus. The hippocampus is the part of the brain that's involved in memory formation. And the whole thing is just full of these little black spots. Now here's an animal that's been treated with our secret potion. And I think you can see a very dramatic difference. So what we've been able to do is to prevent the formation of plaques and in the brains of these experimental animals. And they also do not show the cognitive deficits of these Alzheimer's mice. So we're pretty excited about this. Weihong Song's a pretty smart guy, actually. He was the youngest physician in China at 14. And he comes to us from Harvard. He's doing okay. So he's earned his salary this year. So this is actually very exciting. And it's one group's effort to try to understand the pathogenesis. And by understanding the molecular biology of the disease, by understanding what's wrong, by understanding the enzymes that make up the amyloid core of the plaques, by understanding the way in which it's normally degraded, we have a chance to prevent and even reverse the disease. So again, we're not there yet. This is, if you have any mice with Alzheimer's, please send them to us. We can help them. But it's still a long way between cup and lip to get from here to a treatment that can be applied to people in this room, for instance. So another major disease that we're working on is Parkinson's. There are 100,000 people with Parkinson's disease in Canada today. If we don't do anything, we expect to have 300,000 by 2025. And Parkinson's is caused by the death of a specific population of brain cells. And these are brain cells that use dopamine as their neurotransmitter. I'm sure many of the people in this audience know someone with Parkinson's. So here's the dopamine. It's released from the terminals of these neurons that are located in a place called the substantia nigra. And there it activates dopamine receptors, and you get a response. And that's part of your motor control system. When these dopamine neurons start to die, you get stiffness, you get inability to walk, and you get also this tremor, usually on one side of your brain. And you can recognize these people. They have a very characteristic disability. So what do we do? Well, these neurons are dying progressively. Up until the time you lose the first 50%, you're okay. You have terrific reserves, so you manage. But then once 50% have died, you start to see problems, you come to the attention of your physician. So what do? We basically make the remaining neurons work harder. We give levodopa, which promotes the release of dopamine from the neurons that are not yet dead. And they work harder, and we buy you 5 years or 7 years. So we buy you some time. But in the end, we don't actually treat the disease, because we don't understand yet why they're dying. And so the neurons continue to die relentlessly. And when you're down to one neuron, it doesn't matter how hard it works, you just can't push things any further. In the Brain Research Center, we're very fortunate to have some of the most sophisticated technology in the world to evaluate and study this disease. And we have a world-leading group headed by Donald Kahn and John Stossel who are working on Parkinson's disease. This group recently took delivery of one of the world's most advanced PET scanners. We actually took delivery over 25 years ago of the original PET scanner at UBC Hospital next door. But last year we took delivery of our newest scanner, which enables us to study the dopamine system in the brains of living patients. And if you look here, you can see how much dopamine there is in the brain of a Parkinson's patient who has received a fetal transplant. If you look here, you can see this is what it looks like before the operation, and then afterwards. The operation was actually done in Sweden, and the patients were sent here because we have highly sophisticated technology for doing the imaging. Fetal cells were transplanted into the brains of these Parkinson's patients, and they looked for recovery. And I think what you can see is, frankly, it's not that impressive. The yellow part shows you how much dopamine there was. There's a little more, a little more, a little more. In the end, this clinical trial was not successful. There is now a clinical trial going on, which I believe has much more promise, which is using human stem cells. And again, the technology that we have in our Brain Research Center is going to be critical to assessing how well these patients are doing and how successfully these transplanted cells are in bringing back function to the dopaminergic system. So the other disease I want to talk to you about is bad art. No, actually not bad art. It's stroke. This slide illustrates two things about stroke. First, that it is a disease that affects the cerebral vasculature. And second, that there is a huge time element associated with stroke. Okay. So stroke is the leading cause of disability today. It is the third leading cause of death today. And we expect that the incidence of stroke will double in the next 7 years. So it is a heck of a problem. It's a heck of a problem. Stroke, the brain, you know, these 3 pounds of brain actually consume 20% of your blood supply. They consume 3 pounds is 20% of your glucose as well. So there is a very special and complex cerebral circulation, and things go wrong. So if you have a stroke, it's important that you get to a stroke clinic quickly. You want to get to VGH Emerge or to St. Paul's very quickly. Because if you think about it, what happens in a stroke is a blood vessel either blocks up because something occludes it, or it bursts and spills blood all over the place. In either case, the neurons that are distal to that, behind it, are going to start dying. And as I said, we're not making too many more. So time really is of the essence. We have a therapy for the treatment of stroke. It's called TPA. And what it does is it breaks up the clot in your cerebral circulation. But it's got to be administered within 3 hours after the stroke, or else it's basically ineffective. So what we're working on in the Brain Research Center is to try to understand what happens to the neurons that are on the other side of this blood clot. And it turns, you know, this is just a picture of two brain cells that are talking to each other. If you have a blood vessel here that breaks and these two neurons are deprived of blood, then what happens is that the neuron here, which normally transmits using a transmitter called glutamate to this next neuron, essentially spills its guts and releases huge amounts of glutamate, which is toxic to the next neuron. A little glutamate is okay, a lot is bad. And drug companies have spent over the last 10 years somewhat over $1 billion in clinical trials for glutamate receptor blockers or glutamate relief for stroke. You're out on your behind immediately because they have lost so much money that they really, they really have a bad taste in their mouth. Having said this, this is a huge societal problem. It looks as though they were just looking at it too simply. You're looking now at a very high powered view of the presynaptic side. So you're looking at this. This is on the top is the terminal, and on the bottom is the recipient end of the next cell. This is the glutamate that is pouring out, and it is toxic. It's toxic because of its activity on a particular kind of receptor, the NMDA receptor, but it turns out that the NMDA receptor now comes in two different subtypes. And these two different subtypes connect to different signaling pathways within the cell. And so we now have evidence that if you block this interaction between NMDA receptor and this thing called PSD95, and we've got a secret way of doing that, which I won't bother you with, the amount of tissue that is damaged in a stroke drops by 80%. So it's tremendously exciting and promising. Tremendously exciting and promising. It looks as though, and this $1 billion that was spent to block everything here. And you don't have to block everything, because what you do is you activate death pathways as well as survival pathways, and they balance each other out. You have to be very specific and block this. So that's good. Again, that's good. You have to block this specific interaction. That's good. The bad news is it still has to be done within a couple of hours after the stroke, 3 hours, maybe 5 hours. So time is still a huge problem. So what happens if you're fishing in Fort St. John and you're in the middle of your canoe and you have a stroke? Well, you're basically out of luck. Almost nobody gets to the hospital within the 3 hours that is required for the existing therapy to be administered. My brother-in-law is a cardiologist, and he had a mild stroke 2 years ago. So he was at home, it was the evening. He had a mild stroke, he felt nauseous, he felt dizzy. He said, "Oh, I'm sick, I'm going to bed." So if he didn't recognize that he was having a stroke, you know, how are the rest of us going to do this? Or how are people who are not in close proximity to one of the major stroke treatment areas? And in Vancouver, really, you want to go to VGH or St. Paul. It's probably not good enough to come here to UBC Hospital or to, for instance, Richmond. So what we're working on now is something which I think is it's fair to call it revolutionary. We're working on a stroke treatment that will essentially has two components. It has a sensor that figures out that a piece of brain has just had a stroke. Okay? So you can imagine over time that we're going to give this treatment to people who are at risk for stroke. Because if you think about it, a stroke is actually a very rare event. You know, most people, hopefully most of you will never have one. And yet we can identify the people who are at risk. Who are they? Well, they're diabetics and they're overweight and they have high cholesterol and they've already had a heart attack or they may have already had one stroke. So the idea is to give this to people who are at risk. And then what this medication consists of is two components. One, a stroke sensor. It says, "Oh my God, this person has had a stroke." And then the second component is a defensive protein, like this one, that blocks this interaction, or that breaks up the clot. So the idea is to give this treatment to people who are at risk for stroke, and then what happens after they receive this treatment? Nothing. It just goes into your brain and goes to sleep, and it waits and waits. And then 5 years later, you're fishing in Fort St. John, you have the stroke, the sensor realizes, "Oh my God, he or she has had a stroke." It turns on genes, produces proteins, and the brain is saved. So it's very exciting. Again, we have now done this in a test tube. So we've got cells that we can grow and we can give cells this treatment. And then several weeks later, we give the cells a stroke and we defend them. We're now working on this in mice, and it's looking quite promising so far. Again, are we ready for prime time with this yet? Not yet, but you know, stay tuned. What I've done, you know, mostly so far is to tell you bad news, but there is some good news as well. What I mentioned a couple of times was that we pretty well have all the brain cells we're ever going to have. And that as we get older, there's a steady progression of bad news where you lose brain cells and protein. And I had at one point in this talk a rather dreary litany of things that go wrong as you get older, but I just sort of took it out. It was too depressing to read it all. Because the truth is, it ain't necessarily so. All those things happen to some people, but they don't really happen to everybody, which means that we ought to be able to avoid them if we try hard enough. At any rate, it now turns out some work that was recently done by Brian Christie in our Brain Research Center has shown that you are actually making a few thousand new brain cells every day. Now, that may not seem much in a population of 100 million brain cells, but you're making them in an important part of your brain, the hippocampus, the part of your brain that's involved in learning and memory. And what he did was to study the effects of forced exercise on the production of these brain cells. And it turns out that you make as many as three or four times as many. So if you look here, you see this little red cell? That's a newbie. We have ways of labeling a new brain cells, new brain cells. And if you look here in the animals that were given physical exercise to do, they produce several times as many brain cells. So it's very, very promising, in fact. What was done was you take a bunch of rats and you put them in a box. You take another bunch of rats and you put them in a box with chest problems and social stimulation and these running wheels, you know, that the hamsters will use. And when you do that, you find that these animals produce several times as many brain cells. Then you take away the chest problems, you take away the social stimulation, you take away all these things. What you leave is the running, and that's what seems to be doing the trick. It looks as though that's one of the most important things. So physical exercise seems to be crucial. Now, what we're now trying to do is to understand, so there's more takeaway advice here, which is get some exercise. Okay. What we're now trying to do is to understand what the effects of exercise are in the brain. If we're lucky, we may have a pill which would prevent you from doing all this messy exercise, and maybe you could still get the benefits of that. I guess there's some enthusiasm for that. Well, exercise looks like it does several different things inside your brain. It causes an increase in the levels of several neurotrophic factors. This is one called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It causes an increase in one of these subunits of glutamate receptors, one of the protective ones, the good one, and another receptor here, GluR5. And we're now, Brian's lab is now working hard to understand what the consequences are of turning these things up, how that leads to the birth of new cells. The other thing that exercise seems to do is to increase the concentration of the enzyme that breaks down the plaques in Alzheimer's disease. So that's another good thing to do. The other effect is on the circulation. So we have within our Brain Research Center the capability of looking directly into your brain and to seeing not only the neurons, but also the glial cells that support the neurons, and a blood vessel, or the circulation. So if you look here, this should work. Did this work? No, it didn't work. Oh my goodness. Technology, I'm very sorry. These are many. Well, I think we're gonna have to skip this one. Okay, what this is meant to show you, we actually have the capability. I'm very disappointed that it doesn't work, but I'll try go. No. Okay. It is not meant to be. This is supposed to be a movie in which we can actually tickle a single cell inside the brain. We evoke calcium release within the cell. We have a caged calcium compound. The excitation spreads to other cells, and the blood vessel actually shrinks dramatically. We can shrink it by about 70%. We can basically control the flow of blood within the brain. And we now understand how this is done, and we have a whole series of drug targets that we can now use to try to regulate blood flow. At any rate, exercise seems to stimulate the capacity for blood flow regulation in the brain. And this is something that normally diminishes with aging, and is something that exercise will do for you. So all this leads to the finding that others have made, which is that if you simply go for a walk every couple of days, elderly people have higher scores in cognitive performance, they have longer attention spans, and they have better memories. So this is all consistent with the effects of exercise on neurogenesis and on these older and on these other improvements in the circulation and in the enzymes that degrade plaques. I want to tell you another piece of good news, which is that there is now evidence that the older brain is actually better than the younger brain at solving certain kinds of problems. So it now appears that there's almost a scale difference between the way in which the brains of older people and younger people process information. So younger people are very good at trees. You know, if you've got a Where's Waldo problem, you know, 10 million stimuli, and you've got to pick that Waldo out of that, that's a young man's game. But if your job is to pick a deep pattern out of that same stimulus, that's something that older people are better at. So it's the older brain basically is better at seeing the forest, and the younger brain is better at seeing the trees. So let me just close by saying really what you can do to age gracefully. Eat less. Improve your diet. What I tell people is to eat a lot of different colors of foods. Okay, I think that's something that is probably not a bad idea. It's given what we know about genetic manipulations that lead to longevity, probably taking a multivitamin is a good idea. Exercise. And then I would encourage you to be happy. Avoid stress. I mean, it's really very much in your self-interest. Do whatever it takes. I think you understand this. You know, each of you can solve this problem in your own way. And of course, stay cognitively, socially, and emotionally involved. So I'd like to close. I know you're all here on Saturday night for only one reason, and that's because there's no hockey. So I'd like to close with a quote from the great Canadian philosopher Wayne Gretzky. So, you know, we really do stand at a historic moment in the development of our understanding of the brain. The revolution in computers, in imaging, in genomics, in understanding the signaling pathways within the brain is really giving us a chance to understand the aging process, understand the degenerative diseases of the brain, and to come to brand new strategies. What we have to do is to continue to think outside the box, to think ahead, and I think we have the opportunity to do some great things. Thank you for your attention.
Questions now for a few minutes.
Yes?
Do we know anything generally if a grandparent has Parkinson's about the incidence in subsequent generations?
There's really only a very small increased risk. Parkinson's is like Alzheimer's in the sense that we don't know, you can't catch it from your grandparent. And while there are genetic variants of Parkinson's, they account for a relatively small fraction of the disease. Yes?
Supposing it was a bleed in the brain rather than a clot.
Yeah. Suppose it was a bleed in the brain rather than a clot. Well, in fact, that's one of the reasons you have to get to a sophisticated stroke unit. Because one of the first things they have to do is to... 80% of the strokes are occlusive. They block. The vessel is blocked. 20% are hemorrhagic. If you give a clot-busting drug, you'll help out with the 80%, but you'll make things worse with the 20%. So you've got to get to a sophisticated stroke unit. To have that done. And that's one of the reasons you have to go to VGH or to St. Paul's. If your strategy is neuroprotective, which is you're going to save the brain cells, then you can handle, the treatment is the same for either kind of stroke.
Yeah.
Uh, It's actually quite a hard and challenging diagnosis. And I think what you... I'm a real doctor. I have a PhD. So I can't actually make you better. I can only make you sick. So I would refer you to one of my colleagues in the Alzheimer's, in the dementia clinic at the UBC hospital, who would work you up and would come to that diagnosis. But it's you know, we still need better ways of doing that differential diagnosis. Yes.
In the past half year or so, I ran into several articles about, I think, a Cambridge professor, Aubrey de Grey.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of him?
I might have, but I could have forgotten.
There was a big article about him in the MIT Technology Journal.
Mm-hmm.
He claims that the process of aging is a disease like any other disease that can be studied, the cause established, and a pill found, and once that is done, we live forever.
Well, you know, it... I think actually that what we're going to have are, you know, like many other diseases, is we're going to have a series of incremental steps. So I think, you know, 100 years from now, some scientist will be standing in front of an audience like this saying, well, between 2000 and 2100, the human lifespan increased from 75 to 94, and that's pretty good progress, but we still have lots more to do. I think that, you know, there is wear and tear on the system. It's, you know, it's very hard to reverse some things, and there will be damage, there will be accidents. We don't know of any biological system in which we have infinite life. Yeah. Absolutely, there is. I just, you know, you just can't put everything on one slide. But yes, we do have an active auditory program. We in fact have a tinnitus program, and Dr. Dietrich Schwartz in our center is actually looking for volunteers, or he was a couple of months ago. And so, you know, perhaps you could, you know, speak with him if you know someone who's got the problem. Because he is looking for people with this disease. It turns out that actually one of the problems of aging is that your sense organs actually wear out. You know, so after the age of about 30, you're losing in the auditory system. You're losing 80 cycles every 6 months at the high end. So we're told that you hear from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. Oh. But as you get older, your ability to hear high frequencies is getting worse and worse and worse and worse. You know, I tell people if you're, you know, buying an expensive stereo for someone at our age, you're buying a stereo system for your dog, because they, you know, because they can basically hear the high frequencies and you can't. And if you look at people who make it to 100, they're usually either blind or deaf or both. So no, it's a big problem. So short answer is yes, we do have a program in hearing, and it's actually quite active. Sir,
you mentioned the role of alcohol in dementia. Could you talk about how alcohol damages the brain?
Well, it's, you know. Can I talk about how alcohol damages the brain? We have quite an active program on fetal alcohol syndrome, for instance. It turns out. You know, we also have some work on alcohol in the older brains. I think there's no evidence that moderate alcohol consumption is toxic, but more is bad. In pregnant women, it's a very bad thing to do. And the problem is that alcohol in reasonably high concentration will kill cells and will kill newborn cells in particular. In fact, one of the things that I've been discussing with Brian Christie is whether alcohol will kill some of these newbies that are provoked by all this exercise, and we don't yet know the answer to that. But during the first few years of your life, you actually overproduce brain cells. So you start out with one cell, then you go 2, 4, 8, you know, you overproduce them, and then you actually lose 1/3 of the cells in your cerebral cortex in the first 2 years of your life. And that happens because it's actually sort of a competition for survival in that early time. And alcohol in embryogenesis, so in utero, changes the rules of that game. You actually need that competition. You want to lose the weaklings, and you want to keep the healthy, strong, well-connected brain cells. And if you drink, if the mother drinks alcohol, it really affects, you know, during that competition, it just causes random death of brain cells. And you wind up with a very poorly tuned brain and a lifelong problem. So, I'll just take some from the back. Yes? Can I comment on pain in the brain? Well, there's, you know, there's a lot, you know, there. We now understand a lot more about the pathways that are involved in pain. There look to be very specific sets of nerve fibers that lead to the skin, lead from the skin to the center of the brain, that carry pain information. We understand a lot about the neurotransmitters. We understand how the opiates work. We have several new targets for pain medications that we did not have before. We have a channel that used to be called the capsaicin receptor. You know, when you have hot peppers, well, it activates a particular channel. And the wonders of molecular biology have now revealed that there are 27 family members, including the chili pepper receptor, the menthol receptor, and they're all the same. You know, if you looked at that picture that I showed you a little while ago with these, you know, different kinds of glutamate receptors, there's a whole series of them, and it looks as though these channels, which are called TRIP channels, include some very powerful pain-specific channels. Again, they weren't known even 5 years ago. And now we know where they are, you know, who the family members are, and I think they're going to lead to some new strategies for pain. I should tell you that there's another variant to, you know, I told you about that stroke-triggered vector, this delivery system which would turn on after a stroke. Nothing to stop us from developing one that turns on with pain. So if you've got arthritis, you know, you have bouts of pain, when you have pain, the medication turns on. All you need is a pain sensor, and I think we can develop that. Yeah, sorry.
Is there any research regarding the very prevalent use of antidepressants in terms of the aging brain?
There may be, but I don't know about that research and how it impacts aging. Certainly, depression is a common problem. In the elderly. Depression is exacerbated by stress. Probably running or physical exercise is as effective as many antidepressants in the treatment of depression. I recommend both if you've got a severe case. But I don't actually know what prolonged treatment with antidepressants does to the aging process. I'm not saying it's not known, it's just I don't know. Yeah. 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 So, you know, actually, so, no, you're absolutely right. In fact, if you look at the things that, you know, I didn't tell you that physical exercise increases longevity because there's actually no evidence. Sorry. I've actually been to these, discussions where, you know, you usually have this incredibly fit physician going on about, you know, surely physical exercise increases longevity. And the fact is there is no evidence. Yeah. You know, I think that there is a lot of evidence. You know, what about mental exercise as opposed to physical exercise in terms of keeping the brain from aging? The evidence is yes, but in fact, in this neurogenesis task, it doesn't seem to be that important. At least not in these studies. And I was quite surprised by that. You know, I expected, emotional stimulation will be good for you, you'll get more brain cells, and cognitive stimulation will be good for you, and you'll get more brain cells. No. What's important is running around. Even somewhat mindless running seems to be okay. So, having said this, okay, think back to, to the way I discussed, the question that happened earlier. We know in general that one of the things that, brain cells like is to have lots of friends. In the early years, you really do lose a lot of brain cells, and the brain cells that you lose, as opposed to the ones you keep, are the ones that do not fit into the emerging society that is building within your brain. Once you start to lose brain cells randomly as you age, you can imagine that society, the texture of the society starts to become a bit unraveled. And brain cells commit suicide if they lose their social network. I mean, I'm putting it to you in a very, sort of folksy way, but it is in fact true, and we're trying to understand how that actually happens. So we think that constantly exposing yourself to new stimuli, new situations, new forms of cognitive, pleasure, if I may use that term, is going to diversify the sources of community for a particular brain cell and will be good for it. Okay?
Do you have any information on addiction?
Do you have any information on addiction? There's actually a lot of research going on in the broad area of addiction in neuroscience, and we've got some wonderful people in our center who are doing it. It's also a very strong group in Texas. People are now working on the molecular biology of addiction, seeing what goes on inside the brain when you are chronically exposed to opiates or chronically exposed to other drugs, and it looks as though we are coming to an understanding. We may be able to develop treatments which reduce the probability of being addicted. We are now actually starting to be able to speak about things like gambling addiction at the molecular level. And we may be able to think about things like that in exactly the same terms once you pass some of the boring end organs, if I may use that. We may be able to think of it in really the same terms as opiate addiction, for instance.
One more question.
Okay. Yes?
I recall hearing 10, 15 years ago a study that was saying or suggesting that aluminum was able to induce Alzheimer's. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes, I've heard of it. It looks like it's not really true anymore. What happens is, as when you get into the late stages of Alzheimer's disease, one of the things that happens is that the blood-brain barrier breaks, becomes leaky, and there's lots of aluminum in your environment, and it's usually kept out of the brain by this very well-organized defense system called the blood-brain barrier. It keeps copper out of your brain, keeps aluminum out of your brain, keeps lots of other things out of your brain. And so they found more aluminum in the brain of these terminal Alzheimer's patients. But that doesn't look as though it's the root cause anymore.
Well, I suspect we could continue on for quite a while with questions, but I'd like to call on Professor Sid Katz, Professor of Pharmacology and Director of the Chan Center and Director of UBC Outreach and responsible for Celebrate Research Week and various other organizations around the university to thank our speaker tonight, Sid.
Thank you.
Well, before I thank Max, I'm just going to make a comment. Max, you were helping me there for a while. You said that exercise was very good and running was going to be wonderful for me. Then you had to put in this thing about mindless running, and you've given my wife more and more, fodder now for mindless running while I'm supposed to be taking out the garbage. So we'll have to settle that one later. It's my great pleasure to thank Max, though, for this incredible lecture that he gave us tonight. This is the conclusion of Research Awareness Week, Celebrate Research Week. We've had 45 different activities. We've been going now for 8 days.
And the length and breadth of what research goes on at the university, I think, was truly exemplified both by the week, but also by what you talked about tonight. And this was also a week, very historic, that we opened the largest research facility on campus and probably in British Columbia, the Life Science Institute. And I know that, Max, a lot of your group works in cohesion with many of the different groups there, including the cardiovascular group. So this has been a wonderful week for us and a great achievement. The theme of this week has been ingenuity, seeing the world through new eyes. And what better lecture to give than one which talks about the brain, which a lot of us feel is the last frontier in medical science. Trying to understand what happens in health, trying to understand, as you are, in terms of what happens, what goes wrong in disease. And in order to go any further, as you've pointed out, we're all going to have to be really ingenious, and your 14-year-old researchers are going to have to be even more ingenious. A good example is your discussion of viral vectors. And this whole idea of how viruses that we all tend to think are debilitating and cause a lot of disease, what we've learned from them. Because we know that viruses have to get into cells. And they have to get into cells or they won't survive. So scientists have started understanding the value of taking those viruses, piggybacking the gene products, or in your case, this aspect to stop stroke, to allow them to get into the cells. And this is ingenious for you researchers to take this technology and use it in the way that you have. And this is why we feel that seeing the world through new eyes is the way that science is going to go and develop, and not only science, but the arts and humanities in the years ahead. And it's because of you and your group and these wonderful researchers that we've brought here to the province of British Columbia and those that we've trained over these many years, which is causing us now to be what many of us say, and the president said this twice last week, the golden era of research in the history of our province. And it's thanks to yourself, not only your ability as a researcher, but the fact you've brought many great young people here to our province. You've built up infrastructure many nights, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, writing those grants to produce what is now known as the Brain Research Center. So I think, Max, on behalf of all of us here and those who celebrated research this week, we have a lot to thank you for. Thank you very much. Thank you.